Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, October 17th, just 2 days before my 33rd birthday, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I'm actually sending this out via the interwebs to you while I am in Manchester in the United Kingdom for the QED conference. I'm really excited because I am doing a bunch of interviews here, and I'll be able to share those with you guys over the next few weeks. But in the meantime, I want to give a big shout out to those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, you can always support the show by visiting carasantamaria.com. You can rate and review the show on iTunes. You can shop in the Talk Nerdy store, or you can visit my Patreon page and pledge to support the show. My biggest Patreons this week were Phil T-Bear, Pedro Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much for your continued support. All right, this week is a really fun one. I sit down in person with the author of Rejected Princesses, Tales of History's Boldest Heroines, Hellions, and Heretics. Actually, I should say the author and the artist behind this book because it's beautifully illustrated. So without any further ado, here is Jason Porath. So, Jason, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on.
So, I don't know you. This is a fun one because we've never met before.
That's true.
We've maybe spoken for about 5 minutes before we jumped into this.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
If that. Mostly you were just meeting my dog.
It's a very nice dog.
Thank you. He's about to fall asleep at our feet. But you were recommended to come on the show by my dear, dear friend, Crystal Dilworth. She was on the podcast at least once, maybe twice. You guys
She's
may
awesome.
Remember.
Yeah.
She's a molecular neuroscientist from Caltech who also does science communication and is figuring out her way in the post-PhD world.
I'm always amazed that every single time someone describes Crystal, they come up with a completely different description, all of which are completely valid.
Yeah.
But it's just, she's multifaceted.
She's multifaceted.
She's well-named.
Ex-dancer. We talked about dance a lot on the podcast, so that may be a trigger for you to remember. But she was, I think, one of the earliest guests on my podcast, maybe within the first 20. And you are going to be guest. I can never remember off the top of my head, but hold, please.
Wait for it.
I think the fastest way is to go to this website.
Go to the websites.
My website takes forever to load because it's really bogged down with videos. I have a new person working on that. So I think it's faster to just go to SoundCloud and look. Yep, you will be episode 130.
Ermagerd.
It's crazy to think about. So I'm pumped to have you on the show. Crystal has recommended you multiple times. This time we really pushed and did an email introduction. You are the author of a new book that will be released on October 24th, but you can pre-order it right now.
Yeah, to be on 25th, actually.
25th.
Yeah. What's a day?
I mean, you get there early. That's exactly. I'm trying to help people get a jump
start. I appreciate
it. Rejected Princesses, Tales of History's Boldest Heroines, Hellions, and Heretics.
Yep.
I love that. So when we think rejected princesses, there is kind of a subtle like Disney princess vibe to this, but these are definitely not the Disney princesses we're used to.
Well, I enhance rejected. This is something that I've had to explain a number of times. Originally, this project started as a lark. This was a blog that I started in like 2014 after I left DreamWorks Animation. And I didn't know what else to call it. It was just princesses, women that would never make the animated princess mold. And really the first one that I did, because it was just originally it was sort of a black humor, ha-ha kind of deal, was Lolita, like Nabokov's Lolita, which is a terrible, terrible
Disney
idea.
Disney would not accept
No, it was really bad. But it was such a mind-bogglingly terrible idea. I just wanted to see it exist in some form or another. So despite having like no artistic background, I was sort of like I was an animator, but more of like a programmer type animator.
I was going to say,
like
how do you work at DreamWorks if you have no artistic background?
I was like a technical animator. I was doing like fire and smoke and like liquid calculations. It's very techy. But so I just drew all these because I wanted them to exist. I didn't know what else to call them. So I just called them Rejected Princesses. And it went viral, and two and a half years later, I have a book that's actually in physical form, which trips me out a lot.
But I know. You brought me a copy. It's a really beautiful book. It's got heft.
Yeah.
Not just like a you know, short graphic novel.
It's 400 pages. Like my first reaction upon actually opening it up and holding it in my hands was, oh my God, you could kill someone with this. And my second reaction was, why was that my first reaction?
It goes with the theme pretty
exactly.
well.
I've got, it's 100 different women in there from all throughout history. There's a handful of legends in there. It's got the word count of a novel, the illustration count of a graphic novel, mm-hmm. and the citation count of a dissertation. So there's a lot of work in that.
So when we think about rejected princesses, these aren't like Disney princesses gone rogue. These are real people from history and or real kind of mythological people.
Right. It's 90-95% historical figures.
Gotcha. And these are individual women who were like badasses.
Yeah. Yeah, and they run the gamut. There's certainly a lot of warlords like Boudicca, the first century Iceni woman who burnt London to the ground. And
okay, so there's some evil in here.
There's some evil. Yeah. I mean, she was doing it in revenge, though. So I really struggle to label someone as specifically evil or good in this book. So everybody's a really complicated figure. Even people like – I cover Ada Lovelace, and it's actually Ada Lovelace Day today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Happy Ada Lovelace Day.
Yay.
I cover Ada Lovelace in there, but I cover the parts that sort of get left out a lot of the time of descriptions of her, of like, yes, she was this phenomenal intellect that was able to sort of theorize computers entirely in her head and, you know, made predictions 100 years before the computer revolution that almost all of which came true. But then she was also like, you know, addicted to opiates, and she was she might have cheated on her husband. That's a gray area. Like, was into gambling. Like, she was, you know, not always the best family member. Like, she was a complicated person. Her mother was histrionic and like a little nuts.
Kind of explains a lot.
It explains a lot. Yeah. But I don't like having just a monolithic, simplistic view of these people. So they're really too complicated for the kids' movie mold.
Sure. So they're all real. They're real people, except for the few that aren't actually real.
A few. There's a handful that are not real, but they all get to something that I think is interesting.
Yeah.
So one legend that I have in there is the Shtabai, which is from the Yucatan, and it ostensibly is one of these siren type legends of a monstrous woman that, you know, lures wayward men away. But the backstory for it is an inversion of the Madonna whore thing. So basically, in life, there were these two women, one of which had a lot of male suitors and a lot of lovers, and the other was chaste and virginal. It was like, I don't know, what's the deal with this other you know, lady? And the one who had a lot of lovers dies, and beautiful smelling flowers erupt from her grave, and she's like, well, how can that? I'm gonna die, and I'm gonna have, you know, twice as fragrant flowers. And she dies, and it's nothing but stinky flowers. And she ruminates in the afterlife over, well, you know, she did so well because she was, you know, so free with her love. So I will be free with my love. And because it wasn't a selflessly given love, becomes this demonic creature afterwards. So it's bizarre, like, inversion of the Madonna whore ideology. So I toss that in because it's so counter to a lot of the myths that I grew up with, and I think a lot of us grew up with. So a lot of the myths I toss in there are for that reason.
Where this myth that you were just describing, where is it from?
The Yucatan. It's Yucatan. Mexico.
Gotcha. So it also has different origins than most of our kind of Roman or Greek mythology that then was recapitulated throughout the ages.
And I even have some mythology in there that's tossed in that is from Europe, but you don't really – like, there's a folktale of a princess named Tatterhood who comes out of the womb riding a goat and wielding a wooden spoon, and like, it's hideously ugly, and it's just awesome. She fights trolls and like saves her sister, who has her head swapped out with a cow's head. It's a fabulously weird story, and it's great. And I don't think that she ever get a movie made out of her, but I love it. And so this is a sort of thing that I'm trying to restore a link to all the stuff that gets, you know, pushed aside and is not heralded in sort of our modern culture.
No, for sure. I mean, when I'm sitting here looking through the contents list and sort of just flipping randomly through the – ooh, she's badass looking.
Oh, can I tell you this story?
Yes, you just this is Marguerite de la Roque.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure. It's Rock, Roque.
I was going to say, before we talk about Marguerite, I'm going to keep this page. Okay. I'm going to take one issue.
Okay.
And that issue is that I can't fucking pronounce any of these names.
Yeah, welcome to the club.
Yeah, there are a lot of these amazing people, but they're from places with very difficult to pronounce names.
Yeah, like Trung Nak and Trung Ni.
Yeah, so I'm like, when you do interviews about this, do you just choose to talk about the ones you can typically pronounce?
I really should. Thanks for giving me something to talk about.
Stabe.
One I looked up, so that's Stabe. That was the one I was just telling
you. See, you said Stabe. I didn't see Stabe in here because it's spelled Xtabay.
Yeah.
Okay. So this one, I just randomly flipped.
Marguerite de la Roque.
Yes.
One of my favorite entries. So this is a woman, and I'm not kidding you, this actually happened. In the 1500s, she was on a boat to New France, Canada, the northeastern tip of Canada. Mm-hmm. She was abandoned. She was basically kicked off the boat by her shitty relative for having an affair with one of the sailors on the boat. She is left on an island that is literally called the Isle of Demons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like
with her lover and her servant that had covered for her. She quickly becomes pregnant, has a kid. She is the only one that survives. She survives for, I think it's 2.5 years, hunting bears.
and that's why she has a bear head.
She has a bear head and like
And a pelt.
And a pelt and like an old arquebus, like what first generation firearm.
Mm-hmm. But she does have a baby on this arm.
The baby.
Baby doesn't make it.
Baby didn't make it.
Babies generally didn't make it.
Yeah, but it was 1500s. She was the first European man or woman, I believe, to survive more than one winter in the New World.
It's amazing.
And lived alone, made it back to France, was rescued by Basque fishermen 2.5 years later. that's a better story than Castaway.
No, for sure. And she was probably a changed woman after that.
And what's crazy is that she just sort of disappears she was heralded by the queen at the time, and the queen actually wrote about her and interviewed her and was buddies. But the dude that had marooned her shitty relative, had at that point gotten so politically powerful that she just sort of disappeared. They think that she became a school teacher, and beyond that, nobody knows.
Oh, wow. So it's not like she just disappeared from the history books. She physically disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to her.
Well, she disappeared from the history books. Like, nobody knows what happened. Like, she might have lived a very full life. I don't know.
Wow.
But there's nobody has come across any other record of her. Nobody's come across her grave. That's the case with rather a lot of people that I write about. Nobody knows their final fate.
Fascinating. I mean, when I flip through this table of contents and look at all of the women that are featured, there's a handful of them that I think, you know, everybody would recognize when they look. Joan of Arc, you mentioned Ada Lovelace, maybe not everybody, but most of my listeners would recognize Ada Lovelace. Mm-hmm. Harriet Tubman, you know, these are heroes and individuals that we do know of. There are a lot of people in here that most American listeners might not know anything about.
Oh, yeah.
How did you choose the list of 100 that you chose?
So first off, there are a handful, like you mentioned, like Harriet Tubman and Joan of Arc, that people would know. The entries on them are delving into stuff that people often do not know about.
Ooh, tell me things I don't know about Harriet Tubman.
So Harriet Tubman, arsonist spymaster for the Union. You know this. She burnt down plantations and whatnot. Did you know that she's not smiling in any of her pictures because she doesn't have any front teeth?
I did not know that. I just thought people didn't smile back then in pictures.
Do you know why she doesn't have any? Well, she doesn't have any front teeth. No. She did have a mouth infection while she was out rescuing some folk.
Okay.
And it threatened the mission, so she took out the backside of a revolver and knocked out all her teeth.
So they were rotting out of her head, but she decided to do her own oral surgery.
Yep.
Wow.
She had a scar that's actually depicted in the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
That's
above
a little
her eyebrow.
Above her eyebrow. It was a lead weight that was thrown at her when she was a child that dented her skull and gave her symptoms of narcolepsy for the entirety of her life.
And that was while she was a slave, when she was a child.
While she was a slave, yeah.
Wow.
And she She was purported to have powers that, to hear people describe them, it's basically the same power set that Spider-Man has. Like, she had a spider sense for whenever anybody was coming to cause harm, mm-hmm. and would stop. And there's many, many times that people actually point to the slaves that she was rescuing that she did this. So she was like, someone's coming, no one else could have heard it. And mm-hmm. she stops them. Lo and behold, someone does appear, goes by. And then she, you know, goes on with the mission.
Interesting. I wonder if she had some sort of like really acute sense of hearing compared to everyone around her.
It's possible. What's theorized is that the lead weight injury did a number of things.
Yeah.
Narcolepsy. She heard voices. She was called the Moses of her people for more than one reason.
Interesting. So it could have been confirmation bias too, that we remember all the hits every time that she was like, I hear somebody, even though she never really heard anything. But
right.
we remember all the times that it worked out in their favor.
Exactly.
That's
fascinating. She's definitely been mythologized, but not as much as you might think.
No, because I had never heard of any of these myths about her, because I think she's more modern day.
She is more modern day, but modern day figures, of course, get built up a ton. And like, there's a lot of active mythologization of them. Harriet Tubman didn't have as much as you'd think because her involvement with the Union and all of the spying was sort of kept. The records were kept out of the public eye for a long time. She actually had to sue for God knows how many years to get a pension because it was kept under wraps, a lot of slaves' involvement for fear of retribution by the South.
Yeah. She also led two chickens around on a leash, apparently.
That's true. And whenever the chickens, she would pull the chickens' leashes to make them start going nuts whenever she saw someone that she had worked for as a slave that might have recognized her. The chickens would start going nuts. She would like bend over and start taking care of them, and nobody would pay attention to her. She did all sorts of really clever things. She would have a newspaper and be reading it, and everybody would assume that she was a free woman because no slaves could read. She couldn't read either, I don't believe, but she had it anyways.
Yeah,
she carried a revolver everywhere she went. She was a really tremendous, amazing person, but you get a kind of narrow view of her, I think, in the history books. And that's the same case with a lot of people. You know, Joan of Arc was a terrifying warlord that, you know, killed a lot of people with cannons. She killed many French people that just didn't surrender quickly enough. And her story, you're not even getting the full extent of it because really the person behind the scenes, without whose story, Joan of Arc, doesn't even make sense, Yolande of Aragon, you never hear about.
No.
Yolande of Aragon was the mother-in-law, I believe, of Charles VII, who was the French king at the time. And she had basically pulled together an army for Charles VII to kick the English out of France. Charles VII was basically severely demoralized and waiting for a sign from God. So Yolande of Aragon made one. What she did was she, and it's hard to tie it exactly to her. She was a very, very clever woman. She lived in a province that was known for minstrels and bards and legends coming out of it. So at some point, some bard starts singing in her, who probably was in some way connected to her, starts singing about legend that some peasant girl from the far reaches of France will come out and save us all. Mm-hmm. And 30 to 40 different girls showed up. And Yolande of Aragon picked through them until she found the one she wanted.
Huh.
It was
she was groomed.
It was a help wanted ad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yolande of Aragon then sort of kept everything going. And when Joan of Arc became too much of a trouble, like when they'd basically won the war, but Joan of Arc wanted to continue going on, Yolande of Aragon basically gave her up to the English. And then after all of that, Yolande of Aragon had two protégés, one of which was Margaret of Anjou, who went on to start the War of the Roses and basically mire England in another century of civil war or
so.
Wow. Was it Louis the 11th, the Spider King, who brought France to incredible prominence. Yolande of Aragon is this bizarre shadow figure that only sort of shows up here and there throughout. So, the entry on Joan of Arc is really more about Yolande of Aragon. So if you actually look at the picture for Joan of Arc, Yolande of Aragon is in the background where she wants to
be. Nice. Yeah, I love that because I think sometimes when we think about history and especially deified characters, interesting characters who have become larger than life through the tales that we tell about them, we tend to remember or we tend to tell these tales about these individuals as if they sort of lived in a vacuum.
Right.
Like, of course they had family members and they had friends and they had, you know, mentors and they had enemies. And so learning about those kind of relationships that they have really makes them much more human.
And that's a lot of what I want to do with the book is, you know, all the people in this book are as dinged and dented as you or I. They're as human as you or I. And portraying them otherwise as these saintly figures with the edges filed off, as Harriet Tubman gets to be oftentimes in the history books, doesn't do anybody a good service. I mean, everybody. Like, Amelia Earhart was a polyamorous libertine. Helen Keller was a firebrand socialist in her later years. You know, once they got her talking, they just wanted her to shut up. You know, that sort of thing. So you get these very narrow, censored views of women in history, and this is trying to get around that.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's not a value judgment. It's not like when I read these interesting things about Harriet Tubman, I'm like, oh, she wasn't as pure or as good as we thought she was. No, she's actually more badass the more I read about it. Like, just more complex. She's just less sanitized.
Exactly. And I don't want to sanitize any of the history here. So to get back to your original question, which was like 5-10 minutes ago.
Yeah, which is like there's hundreds of people or there's 100
table of
people.
Contents.
And many of whom we've never heard of.
Right.
How did you choose them?
So I actually had a big spreadsheet that tracked things like ethnicity, era, general personality type, whether they were like an intellectual, professional, a rascal, a martial heroine, any special representation like LGBT. I've got 2 transgender folk in the book. I've got many different religions represented, different indigenous cultures. Like, I was trying to actively to make it as diverse as humanly possible.
Gotcha. So if you had 3 rejected princesses who were all, you know, white, French, with a similar kind of vibe to them, with a similar religious, you might only pick one of them.
Right. I don't want too many to be echoes of one another. And when I do have echoes, what I try and do is have 2 people that come from similar backgrounds but were almost diametrically opposed. I love having characters, like more than one woman in the book, who disliked each other.
Oh, interesting.
So I cover Florence Nightingale and Mary Seacole, who are 2 women who went and engaged in sort of nursing activity in Crimea. Florence Nightingale, of course, everybody knows about. Mary Seacole was a Jamaican woman who ran a business, wanted to be a nurse, and sort of represented more of a natural healing, herbal tradition. And Florence Nightingale hated her. Like, Florence Nightingale actively tried to keep her out of all the business. Florence Nightingale was a product of her time. She was definitely a Victorian era woman who was temperate and didn't want booze around. Whereas Mary Seacole was like, yeah, you have to be happy to heal.
Yeah.
And so she was a lot more raucous. People liked her more. I mean, in terms of raw medical efficiency, of course, Florence Nightingale's going to win. But they're just this bizarre odd couple who are kind of a little bit at odds with one another. And I love that. I love the idea that, you know, these 2 women who are just like, one's really like, you know, prim, proper by the book. And the other is like this jolly, you know, bizarre Jamaican woman. They have to sort of like kind of work together, and they live fairly close to one another. I love that. I have 2 women in the book, Yoshiko Kawashima and Chiu Chin, who were both on opposite sides of the fall of the Qing dynasty in China. Yoshiko Kawashima is actually one of the last Qing dynasty princesses and then went to go live in Japan and took a Japanese name.
I was going
to
say, she sounds Japanese.
Exactly. and Chiu Chin was a revolutionary who helped bring about the fall of the Qing dynasty.
Okay.
So, and I place those 2 entries back to back because they represent 2 different sides of the same coin. So there's a lot of people in the book that were at odds with one another because I don't want it to be a monolithic, like, just because like this one person has to represent all of Chinese history. I think that is the worst thing. So,
and I see a few different, you know, I'm noticing like Egypt is represented multiple times, France, I see Korea, I've seen India in here a couple of different times. So you don't. It doesn't seem like you're trying to represent whole regions with like a single person. You just don't want it to be like all rejected princesses from the same part of the world.
Right. And even when they come from the same part of the world, a lot of times they represent very different eras. So, you know, for Egypt, I might have Hypatia of Alexandria, who was, you know, the first mathematician in history, first female mathematician in history.
So that's really, like, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, super long time ago. Yeah. It was 5th century BC, I want to say.
Yeah, it looks like it. Yeah, into the 5th century. Into the 5th.
Okay,
yeah.
4th to 5th. So, yeah, it's not BC, I don't think.
No. It's after.
So, yeah, she's a real long time ago. I have one that's far longer ago, who's a pharaoh, Hatshepsut. But then I also have Shajar al-Durr, who was ran the Mamluk dynasty or Mamluk Sultanate, who is one of the Islamic sort of caliphate eras of Egyptian history. So they were all very different. So there's
female. That's fascinating.
Oh, she was so interesting.
That's
so
crazy.
Shajar al-Durr, her husband dies. She keeps it a secret. Louis the VII, I believe, invades pretty much as soon as her husband dies and starts the Seventh Crusade. In secret, she takes the reins, continues to say, oh, well, just direct questions for my husband to me. He's not feeling well. I'll take them to him. He's dead. She then takes the reins and stomps Louis the VII, takes him hostage, ransoms him back for 30% of France's GDP.
What?
Yeah, and then goes on to start the ruling in her own name, starts the Mamluk Sultanate, which is one of the only nations to repel the Mongols at that time in history. I mean, the Mongols were rolling over virtually all of the world, and the Mamluks actually turned them back.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I'm looking at the dates. You know, there's a huge spread. You have people from before the Common Era. You have people all the way up to kind of our current century. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talk a lot about, I think that this will become a bigger conversation in the podcast, but we talk a lot about kind of women's history and feminist movements and obviously equal rights for women throughout the ages in different regions of the globe. And it's fascinating to see these historical figures, especially from like very long time ago, doing amazing things, sometimes having to lie and say, oh, it's my husband, he's just asleep right now.
But exactly.
Other times being able to somehow break through. I mean, obviously there's always that context. I'm not sure if any of the women in here, or maybe there are some, lived in an era and lived in a place where it was like, yeah, totally you can be our ruler. You can be such a badass. Like, we don't give a shit. Women are totally equal to men.
Well, that's the thing. Actually, a number of them are respected. They're oftentimes sort of different social constructs. A lot of the African tribes that I cover specifically. So there's a woman named Ya Asantewa who led one of the most successful uprisings against the British, the War of the Golden Stool, or the Ghanans call it the Ya Asante War. She basically, like, after all of the British were just being jackasses and demanding that the Asante hand over their golden stool, which was basically the symbol of the soul of the Asante people.
Because they don't need that anymore.
Yeah, the guy who was the British envoy was just the worst.
Like, yeah,
verbatim quotes from him. It was like, why am I not sitting on this right now? Why have you not, like, he just wanted to place his pasty white ass cheeks on it. It's just horrible. So after that leaves, everybody's cheesed off. Ya Asantewa is the only one that gets out and is just like, fuck this shit. We're going to war. And she doesn't end up becoming, like, she doesn't lead generals into war, but it's a different social position that's just as highly respected.
Gotcha. She, like, organizes.
She organizes. There's another woman in there, got Agon Timé.
I was going to say, how do you remember all
I've
of
got 1,500 of these like kicking around in my head.
Nope, that's Agnodice. Agnodike,
because she's ancient.
Oh, Agnodike.
Yeah, she's one of the first female physicians in history.
Yeah.
So, Agon Timé is, and I'm probably mispronouncing her name.
That's crazy. Those are very similar names.
From Benin, is the kingdom of Dahomey. Prior to Benin, which was infamous for the Dahomey Amazons. Mm-hmm. We don't have a better name for them because nobody ever bothered to ask what they called themselves, but they were a elite all-female squadron of warriors that beat the shit and terrified France.
Wait, and this was real? This isn't mythological?
There are pictures of them.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah. They existed in the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s, and I think maybe on towards the 1900s.
Where were their men?
The men also existed. Okay. There were other fighting forces, but
this specifically from was all like a accounts, squadron of women.
The squadron of women, the Amazons, were by all accounts far more fearsome. They filed down their teeth into points. They drank blood. I mean, like, there's a lot of different things that it's hard to tell how much of this was fact versus fiction, mm-hmm. because certainly there are a lot of very hyperbolic European travelogues that we're yes. not inclined to say nice things about Dahomey, but their queen was the kingdom basically viewed, and many African tribes have similar views on this, that they were twin roles, king and queen, and they weren't often they were oftentimes called by different names like Queen Mother, or like
gotcha.
They're names that don't quite translate. They were different social roles that had different powers. So, like, the king may make the final decision, but the queen gets to decide who sees the king.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of back and forth of, like, they're really both very powerful in different ways. And the woman that I write about, Agon Timé, according to Dahomey tradition, and it's unlikely that this happened factually, but it was a glimpse into Dahomey culture, which is so fascinating that I just had to cover it. She was ousted in a coup and sold into slavery and shipped off to Brazil. According to tradition, she was then brought back, which I have not heard of happening.
Yeah.
Like, and they're kind of dicey with the details in the legends.
Mm.
Historians who've looked into it say that it's most likely that there was sort of an arranged business dealing with agents abroad to get her back, if indeed that did happen. I posit a Quentin Tarantino type movie where the Dahomey Amazons, the elite fighting force, go to Brazil, break out their queen, and get back to Dahomey. Because
uh-huh.
it fits in with the legends that they have. It may not be factually like accurate, but I mean, these are the stories they tell themselves. And that's what I wanted to get across in this book is like, okay, I will denote when things may not be historically accurate, but these are legends that are passed down. These are, in a way, they're molds for people to emulate, molds for girls and women
sure.
to emulate. That have been lost or scrubbed out or deemed illegitimate for one reason or another. And they're not deemed illegitimate by Benin nowadays.
So there's sort of this like Howard Zinn approach of telling the history of these individuals from as many historical records through their own perspective as possible.
Yeah. No matter how morally reprehensible I may find it,
yeah.
they are always the hero of their own stories.
Yeah. And it's important that we're not always telling their stories from like a white colonial perspective that we're
Absolutely.
Looking at, even though sometimes that's all that the historical records contain. But when possible, trying to find those stories from the mouths of the individuals that were experiencing them.
Yeah. And that's one of the hardest things whenever I cover cultures that don't have a long written record.
Mm-hmm.
Inevitably, you will have legions of historians basically saying nothing that they've said is in any way verifiable, and you just toss it all out because it's just hearsay, which is just a shame.
Yeah.
There's some of it that absolutely fits, and some of it where, you know, it's, you know, centuries of playing telephone. So, of course,
yeah.
it's gotten corrupted, but there's a truth there. And I think to toss it all out does them and their entire culture a disservice. So I try to be both, a Western, like, okay, well, here's the historic perspective. But ultimately, this is a book of stories. And while I try to denote, you know, the likelihood of whether it's happened or not, I do it at the end because in the end, it's a story.
Yeah.
And like, I don't want it to be right at the front and lessen your enjoyment of the story.
Sure. And I mean, that said, even include a few mythological characters within
there's
this
a handful
for the same reason.
But I mean, to be fair, 90%, 95% of the people in there are historical figures. Like, I don't want to get too far in the weeds on this, but you go back far enough in time in any culture and everything starts becoming legends.
Yeah, and it's sometimes hard, even if there's real evidence that they existed, it's hard to tell if they existed the way that the record says that they did.
Exactly.
I mean, I think Jesus is a good example of
that. That's a great example.
We don't know if Jesus actually existed, and if he did, we don't know if he was anything like what the record said, and he probably didn't have any magical powers, very likely was
right.
Just, I don't know, little forward thinking and like hygiene and things of that matter. So I'm looking here and I would love to, we'll get back to some of the why of the written part of the book and the why. I want to know the origin story. But before we do that, I would love to talk about the actual illustrations. You described yourself as an animator, but a technical animator who had no artistic ability. But these look like they could be cells from any, you know, DreamWorks, Pixar, Disney film.
Well, thank you.
Like they have that sort of big-eyed, bright-faced. I don't know. There's a certain
it's
style
definitely the
to
aesthetic
them.
That I'm. It's in concert with.
Yeah.
In dialogue with that aesthetic.
But there's a lot of detail here. There are a lot of layers, and I'm noticing as you're telling some of the stories, and I'm looking at the corresponding imagery, and these aren't just like little sketches within the text. These are like full plates, like full figure, full color plates that precede or end each chapter.
They're sort of like a poster for a movie that's never
been made. Yeah, and you know, I'm looking at them and it's really cool how you're mentioning all of these interesting details that most people don't know. And they're kind of all represented within the images. So you say that you didn't know anything about illustration. Did you take a class? Like, how did you? Because I don't think I could just will myself to be this talented.
I mean, you osmos a bit from just being around
it.
Amazing people, amazing artists.
Yeah.
And they had little draw by yourself classes that weren't instructed. It was just you'd go and do life drawing and during lunchtime at DreamWorks sometimes. But most of it is just me beating away at it. When I first started 2.5 years ago, I was doing work that would never make it into the book now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've gotten so much better. And I've actually, on the website, which I maintain, I post new entries like every week or two.
What is it? Rejected Princesses?
Rejectedprincesses.com.
Nice.
Yeah, it's also on Facebook and Tumblr and everywhere. But I make a point of showing, like, here's how I've progressed. I didn't come out of the womb like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I get things wrong all the time. Like, it's I put a lot of effort into it. And I'm glad that's come across because it's something that I've, like, it's been a lot.
Yeah.
But I'm not a historian. I'm not a woman. Most of these cultures I have no earthly attachment to. I'm a straight white dude from Kentucky. I'm like the least likely person to take on any of this, but I just wanted it to exist. So on the website, I have a whole section devoted to corrections, and I actually give out these certificates saying that so-and-so is in perpetuity smarter than me. I don't have an ego about this. I just want it to be right.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it sucks when someone's real, real mean about, like, you're giving Edward the second a too hard a time. Isabella of France is not nearly as nice as you make her out to be. And I'm like, okay, well-reasoned points. Here's a correction and a certificate. Cool. Is everybody on board? Cool. Anybody else? Anything to say? All right. Cool. Moving on.
I love that.
And so the artwork is much the same. It's like it's evolved. It's gotten better. I try to be real human and upfront about where I am and my failings. Like, I look at the book and there's even entries that now I would write differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I look at it and I know that there's going to be some angry emails about some of them.
I've heard that from a lot of authors, that they have this, you know, the enemy of the perfect is the good.
Exactly.
You know, it's like really important that at a certain point, it is what it is.
Yeah, pencils down.
And like you said, how long ago did you send this into print?
It was over a year ago.
Yeah. So that's a year of like ruminating.
Oh, yeah.
On things that you can't change because the type is set, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's a common refrain from authors, that If I spent 10 more years on this, it would be even, but you'll just have to do like a version two. That's
yeah,
how it works.
It's terrifying to me because I've got a fairly large and very vocal following online. Mm-hmm. And I'd say about half the time I wake up to angry emails. Like I get a lot of hate mail, and it's not even a political, like I definitely get a lot of them from the men's rights folk. I've been told I'm a traitor to my gender, which is what I want on my tombstone. I'm so proud of that. But I also get it from the left. I've got people like in the trans community who got really mad at me. I covered a trans figure, a Native American two-spirit who's in the book, mm-hmm. Whose name is Ashtish, and they demanded that I use the phrase assigned male at birth because there was no other phrase was acceptable, except there was no evidence that the crow ever assigned gender at birth.
Interesting. So that's I went of into like an American cultural.
Right. And they wouldn't accept any other phrasing.
Yeah.
They're literally I talked with many people like, is there any other phrasing? And all my trans friends and exes were like, no, it's fine. I don't get what they're up in arms about, but it's the internet. And so I like half of the entry ended up being this long digression into the terminology of two-spirit and how English is imperfect, and I was trying my best. And eventually I did a settle on assigned male at birth and then made an immediate footnote of like there is no evidence that this person was ever assigned male at birth or even assigned male by their tribe. They were assigned male by Christian missionaries and, you know, white assholes basically. But so it was, I get a lot of angry mail, and so it becomes a thing where whenever I write something, there's a voice in the back of my head of like, what is the angry email gonna sound like?
Well, and it's funny because you must deal with a blowback of individuals who wonder like, well, how do you have the right? Right? Like you're a dude.
Oh, yeah, check my privilege.
Yeah, like why are you writing about these badass women as a dude? And what are you trying to get away with here? What are you trying to prove?
Right.
You know, and it's an interesting question. Obviously, this interests you and it was on your mind and you started a blog and eventually you had enough content to make a book. But I guess the core question is, what is it about these, you know, fascinating women that was so compelling for you to continue your work? And why just focus on rejected princesses and not try to maybe do the opposite and humanize male sort of deified figures and show their more feminine and their softer side and their sides that we don't already know about?
Right. God, I've got the long answer and the short answer.
We got time.
All right. The short answer is, I always thought these were cool stories and more people should know about them. Mm-hmm. This all spun out of a conversation I had with a bunch of ex-coworkers at DreamWorks over what's the worst idea for an animated princess musical. And we came up with Alita, but I tossed out a bunch of different ideas like Boudica or Jingam Bande, who's the mother of Angola, or a lot of these different people that nobody at work had heard of. And I was like, well, that's a shame. Everybody should know about them. So
you already had some sort of historical interest
there. I was a Wikipedia junkie. I'm just an info junkie. So like I knew. The list started out at like 30, 40 people.
And those were just people you kind of like remember.
Like
from,
off the top of my head. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And then it's 1,500 now and growing way faster than I can possibly work.
And all women still.
All women.
Interesting.
Yeah. Some of them are, there's some that I've got on the list, just I'm not going to do entries on that are trans men.
Sure.
Assigned female at birth. But that I've got on there more for, when people ask, because I get a lot of people asking about like, well, can you list some, you know, historical bisexual figures? I'm like, here's my list.
Yeah.
So that's the short answer. The longer answer is of why I do this is my mom.
Mm-hmm. I saw that you dedicated it to her.
Oh, yeah. My mom was born in Kentucky. I'm from Kentucky. She was born in Kentucky in the 40s, mm-hmm. and she's an unbelievable, unstoppable super genius who was born in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And she spent the first 30 years of her life or so really just trying to break away from that. She was not supported by people in her community, people in her family, her first husband. Like there's a lot of stuff she had to fight against. I mean, and she tried fitting herself in this box. I mean, it's weird to think that my mom was like a cheerleader it's so not her. But I know she was, and she married a dude from the football team. And that, again, not her. She finally breaks away, joins the counterculture, and is just like, you know, goodbye to my entire life. I'm going to just go off in the weeds and find myself. And she starts blossoming. She becomes a published author. She's starts, you know, getting back into the art that she always wanted to do. And just really, she's on the cusp of making all of everything she's ever wanted to happen come true. And she could be anything, and she chooses to be my mom. And the way a lot of it shakes out is that her energies go towards raising me and my brother and my endless legion of stepbrothers. I have 7 brothers and no sisters.
Oh my God.
And she never regretted that for a second. Mm-hmm. She never questioned it, but I did. I always grew up, I'm like, seeing all the stuff that my mom is just incredible. And I wanted her to never, ever have a second doubt that it had been worth it. I wanted to do something worthwhile, that would pay mom back, that would reach out to women who had been in my mom's position, that had grown up not seeing any women like them and not getting any stories of women who'd overcome. And then to some degree, I also, it was wondering, seeing all the different men who had in some way not done well by my mom, sometimes through no fault of their own. Sometimes it was, you know, they're dudes from an older generation. You know, the patriarchy screws everybody, is, you know, to get really political
about it. And sometimes there are no excuses.
And sometimes there's no excuses.
Yeah.
I try to be very humanizing towards everybody. But
sure.
Looking at this, I really worried about being another dude who wasn't, who didn't listen, who didn't support, who wasn't good to the women in his life. So it's been a long-standing journey of mine to try and figure out, okay, what does being a stand-up dude look like?
Mm-hmm.
And this is one part of that.
How long has this project, from publication to first conception, how long has it been?
I started in April, May of 2014. I got the book deal, sort of a handshake signature, in September of 2014, and I turned in the first draft September 1st, 2015.
When you first started the project, first conception, were you still working at DreamWorks, or had you already left?
I had come up with the idea in February, and then I left in April. Okay, I have a lot of other things. It was one of like 17 different projects that I had percolating when I left DreamWorks. This was the one that I knew that if it was going to have an audience, I'd be able to tell very fast. And it was, even if it didn't, it was going to teach me a lot of skills that I wanted to get better at, like illustration, like research and writing. So it seemed like a good first start, and it went viral 3 days in, and it's been my life nonstop, 24/7 ever since.
So this has been your full-time job since you left DreamWorks as an animator.
Yeah. If you go on the website, you'll see there's an enormous amount of stuff on there.
And have you been able to monetize it, or have you used your own savings and your own personal kind of, I mean, obviously once you finally sign a book deal, then you get an advance. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the advance is helpful. Sometimes it's less helpful than you would like. But regardless, writing a book is not generally a big moneymaker for most people.
No.
It's a labor of love.
Oh, yeah.
Were you able to just kind of think ahead and plan to be able to?
So I'd saved up before I left DreamWorks.
Yeah.
I had, I knew a year in, and I worked there for a little over five years, that I was a bad cog for that machine. I was just, I needed to not be there. And so
not good at the corporate life.
I could tell stories. I feel bad. I was not a model employee. I did great work, but I did not have the great attitude.
I'm very similar in a structured kind of corporate environment.
And it wasn't fair to anybody else to be that guy.
Or to yourself, really.
No.
Yeah.
So I left. And I'd saved up because I knew that was going to be a thing that I was going to do. So after How to Train Your Dragon 2, I left. And I had a bunch of money saved up. So I've been living off of that and the book advance, and I did a very, very brief stint doing visual effects because publishing takes forever to pay you.
Yeah.
I did a brief stint working on Independence Day 2. I made Liam Hemsworth CGI urine, which may be the high point of my career.
That's amazing. So you can like point to it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's really the high point of the
flows?
Movie for a lot of people. Yeah. It was a crack team of people that in an hour we decided this is not going to be a practical effect. We are going to do this CG and it's going to be on all our reels. And so we had I was on prime simulation duty. Then there was a secondary simulation of splashback. There's a guy on continuity puddles. There's a guy on steam. Like we thought this out. Visual effects is no joke. But yeah, I've basically been living off of savings for 2.5 years now in the book advance, and it's not been easy.
Yeah,
it's definitely very nerve-wracking. It's you have to cut back on everything. Dating is hard. Like everything gets harder. But it's been very rewarding, and I'm launching a Patreon soon that I've got a ton of rewards. Like it's looking at how much I've put together and then talking to people at Patreon, they're just like, you have overthought this.
Yeah.
Like,
so wait,
that's my MO.
You haven't launched it yet.
No, I've been putting all the work together. Can I tell you all the stuff that
I'm interested. Well, first of all, do you know what your launch date is going to be yet?
I do not. I'm trying to get it before the book comes out.
Okay. So you're hoping to do it within the next week or so, but,
yes.
Or 2 weeks. But, well, it sounds like you've done a lot of work. What work have you done so far? What are your
rewards? So
for
every image I've ever done, every entry I've ever done, I've maintained in progress images. So like you see this final beautiful painted image, but I take it down to just the flat colors, just the black and white ink. So it sort of looks like a coloring book. So
by the way, before
pencils
before,
on and on.
Is this hand done or is this all digital?
Digital.
It is. Okay. Yep. So when you say like black and white ink, you mean black and white digital ink?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay, cool. So you draw, do you sketch it by hand and scan it?
No, it's all digital.
Like, wow, you physically draw all the lines digitally.
Yes. And I've got time lapses for nearly all, like everything I've done since January of 2015. It is over 1,000 man hours of time lapse videos. That's another backer reward.
That's really cool because if you were, you know, painting all of these things by hand and then having to scan them in for typesetting, you wouldn't actually be able to get that sort of like data.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Unless you had a rig and you hooked up a camera and
right.
you positioned it the same way every time. So it's cool doing things. Well, first of all, it blows my mind that anybody could draw like a squiggle digitally without just using a stylus and drawing it with your own hand.
Well, I do have a stylus. I'm using one of those Wacom tablets. So,
gotcha.
Yeah,
so it's like hand sketches mixed with layers and mixed with all those. It's crazy to me.
Yeah.
I do not understand digital art.
And I'm happy to teach you if you want to learn.
I am one of those people who can't draw a stick figure. I have a very bad sense of foreground and background. I have a bad sense of scale.
Everyone has to start somewhere.
That
Believe
is
me,
true.
I was not particularly good. You're seeing, you know, me after 2.5 years of intensive every single day effort.
But the fire, let me just tell you, you had a lot. You had a lot of training in that fire.
So that is actually whenever there's a practical element like a fire, water, just sort of like effects
clouds,
elements,
yeah.
clouds. I rock those because I know exactly what they should look like. But people, what do people look like? I'm never around people.
It's actually true though. It's funny because it's all beautiful, and I think that you have really mastered the forms of the people. But there are really stunning background elements that sort of disappear, like they do, you know, like they're meant to. And even foreground elements. Maybe there's an elephant in the foreground of one of them. like the texture of the grass or of the clouds or of a mountain in the background that. that are really stunning, like the sand blowing around, and that must kind of tap into some of the work that you had done previously.
Absolutely.
So, okay, so you have all of these cool things, like you've got time lapse, you've got intermittent cell
drawings.
Yeah, so
I've got the in-progress sort of cell. Mm-hmm. It's a good way to talk about it. I've got reference imagery mm-hmm. for every image I've ever done. It's over 5,000 images for everything.
Oh, wow.
And then I'm working on putting together limited search access to my master list of 1,500 women that mm-hmm. is constantly growing, that I annotate and adds. So you'd be able to search for, say you're doing research, I want to find every black woman on this list who was alive in the 16th century who was bisexual. Bam. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
I'm trying to have like a Google Maps style search interface so you can like, you know, zoom in the map to a certain area and be like, search in this area for everyone. It's all of this is a lot of work, and it's all sort of tied in with a Patreon API to my website. So like if you'd be able to log into Patreon, visit my website, and then different things would unlock.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, just sort of seamlessly.
Yeah, most people don't. My Patreon is not that complicated.
I'm
like, I'll send you a t-shirt.
Yeah, I go to far too much effort.
No, that's cool. I could learn a lot from you, because I have been thinking lately about beefing up the Patreon and having interesting rewards that are more personal, you know, like maybe one-on-one chats and things of that nature that I think are a little more meaningful for individuals. Right now it's kind of, you know, just a few levels: a virtual hug, a shout out on the podcast, a signed photograph, and I think a swag bag. Depending on what level you contribute. But the fact that your Rejected Princesses project as a whole, it's not just a book. It's so much deeper than that. And there's different ways that individuals can delve into it. The idea of monetizing it in such a way, I think this is really smart, that on its surface, it's democratized. You know, everybody has access to a lot of the content, because we don't want to limit that. Same with my podcast. It's free for anybody to download. Mm-hmm. That's really important to me. But then for the individuals who are able to support it and mm-hmm. who can help out in that way, to know that they're keeping the open access available for everybody else, but then that they get something special on top of it that's like just a little... It's a nod to the patron, you know. It's a thank you for patronizing the art.
Absolutely, yeah. And the book is another sort of monetization of that. Is 80% of that is book only. 20 of the entries are also on the web, mm-hmm. But you know, 80 of them are you can only see in the book.
Yeah.
And in fact, all of the behind the scenes content for those entries. And I'm still in negotiations with the publisher over this, but I believe I'll be able to get them on board to where if you're able to, you can only see them if you're a backer and you can prove you have a copy of the book.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's cool. Like with some sort of number or something like that.
Yeah, a number.
There must be a way to track these things.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I'm trying to work that out with them. What I'm actually looking at doing is something out of old school text adventures where... it'll randomly ask you like three questions of like, what is the fifth word on page 73?
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. And just having a big sort of random, like, you know, what is, you know, word X on page Y?
Yeah. Where after a certain point, it's like, not worth it to hack it. I'll just buy the damn book.
Exactly. Like, and it's really easy for people who have the book. It's like, that's what, 10, 20 seconds of work.
Yeah.
So that sort of hits a sweet spot for me, but we'll see if they go for it.
I like that better than filling out a CAPTCHA or whatever those damn things are called. Like, prove you are a human.
Exactly.
Like, okay. That's really cool. So I'm a huge fan of Patreon. I think it's a really cool
I'm looking forward to
interface.
It.
I think that it allows people to show to show what they care about and to put their money in places that matter to them and directly fund the artists instead of paying out a middleman, which is also really cool. It's great that you have something tangible that you can offer individuals. I think that they'll respond really positively to that. That's something that I'm one of these people who works in this space where the product is ephemeral. It's digital, you know, and that becomes really difficult. There's not a physical thing there. And so always trying to pick people's brains and figure that out. But it would be cool to talk a little more offline.
Oh,
even.
For sure. Yeah.
You guys won't get to know our secrets. But in the meantime, I have to say that I'm really impressed by the... I think the story behind the project makes it a lot more meaningful, but I'm also really impressed by the finished product. It's really beautiful. I'm looking forward. See, I just saw it for the first time today, you guys. I'm really looking forward to digging into it and reading stories about some of the people that I thought I knew about and maybe didn't know what I thought I knew, but also about these people whose names I've literally never heard before. And, you know, expanding, like, oh, come on, man. What is this Indonesian name?
Kumal Lahayati.
Beautiful, actually. And you know, expanding some of my breadth of knowledge, I think this has been really fun because this is usually mostly a science podcast. And I think that there are themes because I think social justice is a big part of the podcast. And you know, across the board social justice, whether we're talking about LGBT or ethnic minorities or women specifically, I think it's really important to bring that to the forefront of the conversation. And I think that this is cool because it dips into a lot of my interest areas, but it's not something that I would typically talk about on the show. So I've been able to learn a lot. I know I'll be able to learn more reading the book.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Of course.
I'm glad that you like it. And there are plenty of scientists in there, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, which is super cool. Yeah. Like, but also, honestly, like, we all have these blind spots. We talk about this a lot on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, the other podcast I work on, where there will be a story that we're discussing, and there will be some sort of, like, gap in our knowledge. Like, each individual host on that show who collectively... Like, we have a lot of expertise in a lot of areas, but there will be some sort of gap in our knowledge where it's like, I've literally never heard that word before. And people are like, how the fuck could you have not heard the word? Blah, blah. And it's so funny how that happens, how you throw yourself in to something specific, and sometimes you have blinders on to whole other areas. And some of these historical figures from parts of the world that I just... unfortunately didn't get to take those classes in college, or I just never took the time to read about... especially focusing so much on science. I'm super excited to dig into that. But before I let you go, I always end every podcast the same way. So, and you're in person, which is fun because I've been doing a lot of remotes lately. It's always more fun to do this part in person. I always ask my guests the same two questions. Okay. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on them. And they're kind of shit questions. So I apologize. They're big picture questions.
I like big pictures.
Good. So when you think to the future in whatever context is relevant to you, so it could be very personal or it could be like big picture global stuff. The first question would be, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? What are you most worried about? What preoccupies you the most? And on the flip side of that, to end on a lighter note, what are you most excited and optimistic for?
So the first one is kind of a three-part answer. Climate change, mm-hmm. Trump.
Uh-huh. And common themes.
Yeah, common themes. Yeah. And how am I ever going to have a normal, like, life and family and kids and everything, living a artist's existence? This is still relatively new to me, and I don't know how I'm going to put bread on the table, sort of thing. So that's what keeps me up at night.
And that's, I think, a very, very common refrain amongst individuals with a similar goals in life to create and to mm-hmm. make things. Luckily, I think that you are going to be pleasantly surprised by your book sales.
I hope.
And I think that going the Patreon route and starting to learn, I think a lot of times as artists or creators, individuals worry about monetizing because they think that the people who are consuming the information are going to feel angry or like it's not justified. But the truth of the matter is it's a very warm community of individuals who want to give. And so I think before you know it, like you're going to put your Patreon online and be like, oh shit, why didn't I do this sooner?
yeah. The thought has occurred to me.
Yeah, and those are not platitudes. I fully think that's true. I cannot give you any sort of comfort about Trump or climate change.
I just like keep refreshing 538 and hoping that the numbers are better.
But yeah, when you look to the future, there must be some really excited things, some hope.
Excited things. I mean, the book coming out, all of my energy for the past 2 years has been this. And going on a little East Coast road trip. I hesitate to call it a book tour because it's a little late in the game to arrange signings, although I'm trying. But just seeing friends out there, getting out of LA for a bit, seeing my parents, and like having a quiet holidays disconnected from the world where I can finally sit down and just like be a human again, because I've just been working 80, 90, 100 hour weeks for 2 years.
Yeah.
And it's taken a toll, and I really just need to like sit down and sleep. I'm looking forward to sleeping.
That's that's always something that's good to look forward to. I think that when you are, if you wanted to, obviously, if you just want to unplug and unwind, you absolutely should. But if you wanted to, I would venture to bet that individuals will want to meet with you and to hear you read excerpts and to get your signatures. Guys, you should reach out to Jason on social media, and especially once you've gotten the book, or if you're excited to get the book, you can, I think you can pre-order right now, right?
Yeah.
Actually, as of this airing, the book will be out in like a week, so you can definitely pre-order then, and you absolutely should. But you should reach out to Jason on social media, tell him what you think, and let him know if you want him, you know, to come to your town. Especially, you're local to LA, right?
Yes.
Especially if you're here on the West Coast, or if you're on the East Coast and he's doing his little mini vacation / potential book tour. How can people say hi? You know, they can go to rejectedprincesses.com or that Facebook or whatever, but what's your Twitter where they can say hello?
So my Twitter handle is just at Jason Porath.
Okay.
Rejected Princesses is too long for Twitter, turns out, so I can't do that.
Well, it would waste too many of the characters.
It would waste too many. And like at RP is already taken, so what you're going to do.
Can't go too short.
Yeah.
So at Jason Porath, but Rejected Princesses on the web and on Facebook?
On the web, on Facebook, on Tumblr, on Instagram. I'm on a lot of places.
And probably, I'm assuming, your Patreon will be / Rejected Princesses.
I think it's actually / Jason Porath.
Oh, really?
I'm not 100% sure.
The two.
But if you go to the website, I mean, once it launches, I'm not going to be shy about having links on any of them. So it'd be pretty easy to find that.
Cool. Yeah. Very cool. Well, Jason, this has been a ton of fun. Like I said, I learned a lot. I'm really looking forward to learning more. Thank you so much for taking
the time and coming to join me.
I
always love yammering about this. I don't know if you can tell.
It's absolutely great. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk learning.